Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon to take your calls if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith or would like to discuss anything on those topics. We can discuss them. And if you have a different viewpoint from the host, you're welcome to call about that. Even if you're not at all a believer in the Bible or in Christianity and would like to discuss your beliefs and your reasons, you're always welcome to do that here. The number to call is 1-800-438-5090, and it looks like our lines might be all full, but I'm not sure about the third one of the lines. But if you give me a call and the lines are full, then just call back after we've talked to some of these callers, and we'll have a line open for you. John from Corvallis, Oregon is our first caller. John, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'll try and keep this real quick since you got other people on the line. Last week I called in and we had pretty good discussion about science and religion that got a little bit dicey towards the end. And I'm interested in calling in and eventually being able to talk about evolution, particularly some of the stuff that I found really fascinating with evolution, which with symbiotic relationships is where a lot of my studies have been. How those form and how those function. But first of all, I feel like it's kind of important that we kind of have a basic common ground. We understand where we agree and disagree. And just kind of going over our conversations, you and I agree on almost everything having to do with science. We believe that we both agree that science does not disprove the existence of God. We both agree that when people like Richard Dawkins are teaching atheism, they're not doing science. They're simply teaching atheism. That Christians and religious people of all kinds can be perfectly good scientists. That science is not the only valid method of exploration. There's art, there's philosophy, there's all these other things. And that science is extremely powerful. It's helped explain many phenomena which were once believed to be supernatural. And our main disagreement last week, which I mean, clarify this a little bit here, was on on the idea that the origin of life can never be understood through science. So you were saying that it can't be understood through science because it's a supernatural event, and that was bothering me. And the reason that those types of statements bother me is that if we accept those conclusions, then we give up trying to solve the puzzle before we even started. So, you know, if you're solving a crossword puzzle, and you have to have faith that the puzzle is at least somehow solvable. Otherwise, you're going to give up as soon as it gets difficult. And so that's where a lot of statements that I hear coming from the creationist movement are just sort of naysaying statements.
John, if the problem we're trying to solve is where did life originally come from, and you say, if we say it's supernatural, we're giving up on the quest. No, we're not. We're saying we have found the answer. The answer is supernatural. If the answer is supernatural, you don't have to look somewhere else for it. Like if I ask my wife if she's seen my cell phone and she says, yes, it's here in the living room, then I don't have to look in the bedroom for it anymore because it's been found. The truth is that life requires information in the DNA molecule, and it's incredibly complex information. And many scientists, including atheists, have said this defies scientific analysis. We do know some things. This is not a God of the gaps. This is not saying we don't know how science can explain this, but so we're going to stick God in there. This is not an argument from what we don't know. This is an argument from what we do know. What we do know is that intelligent information comes from an intelligent mind. That we know. We've got like thousands and hundreds of thousands of examples of that. We have zero examples of intelligent information coming from anywhere other than an intelligent mind. So it's not like there's, you know, two camps on this. There's only one camp that's based on observation. Observation tells us that information comes from an intelligent mind. And science doesn't have to keep looking for ways for information to not come from an intelligent mind. Why should they? When we actually know of an intelligent mind from which it came. I mean, you could say, well, we don't know that, so we're going to keep looking, and you're okay to do that. But I can say with confidence you won't find it. It's like if you find the Encyclopedia Britannica laying around, And I say, yeah, well, this is published by such and such a publisher, and these articles were written by such and such people. And you say, well, I'm not satisfied with that. I want to find a naturalistic way where no human mind was involved, and I'm going to keep looking until I find one. Well, you can keep looking, but we happen to know that you're looking in the wrong direction. And scientists and philosophers who are atheists even have sometimes had to come to the point where they admitted this. That's why Anthony Flew became a deist. He gave up his atheism. He was the leading atheist philosopher in the world for 50 years. And he, just before he died, actually said, well, this information, it just hasn't, he had to admit it. Yeah. Information comes from a mind. If you've got information, yeah, you've got a mind that caused the information. That's just, it's like if you see scratches on the seashore that were made by the random wandering around of seagulls, you can say that's random. But if you find, excuse me, written in the sand, a message, Mary loves John, you know a mind created that because there's information. It's not just scratches. Those kind of scratches would be simple enough that nature could produce them, but nature couldn't produce the information that they contain. That's the thing. That's how we know there's a mind behind them. Same thing is true with the DNA molecule.
There are, so you're right in several points here. There are a lot of people who have given up on the question, whether they're religious or not, who have given up. There are other people who have given up on the idea that we're on the right track. So there's, like at Cambridge, for example, there's another completely different study than what you typically see when you look at life origins. So the mainstream scientific idea is that life is an emergent property of matter, so that there's some sort of self-assembling property of matter that can produce life. So that's the major idea that most scientists are chasing right now, but there's other ideas as well. Like you said, this guy in Cambridge is chasing after, he's looking at something he calls morphic resonance, which is completely different than the mainstream scientists. And then there's the intelligent design group that's looking into, you know, where is the edge of evolution? Where do you actually need an intelligent mind in here? So there's lots of different ways to look at it. And I'm not saying that one should be shunned and one should not be, but there are, as we continue to look into this question, we keep on finding stuff. We keep making discoveries. And that's what's so beautiful about science, is that we keep on looking, we keep on searching, and we keep on discovering new things. So, why it bothers me when people say, we can't figure this out. This can't be figured out through science, because we keep hearing that, and then we keep figuring things out.
But no, wait. Scientism would say that we can explain everything through science, and that it's therefore foolish to reach a premature conclusion that something can't be found out by science. But we don't have to be scientismists. A scientismist is a person who believes that science is all there is. But you already admitted at the beginning of your call that science isn't all there is. There are other fields of knowledge that aren't from science. And therefore, when we find something in nature that does not, that has a better explanation than a scientific one. It has a personal, explanation. A person wrote this book. Therefore, we're not going to look for a scientific cause that it arose just from paper and ink, you know, by natural processes. We're going to recognize, okay, we're not stupid here. We recognize that a book was written by a person. If someone says, no, we need to keep looking for a way that this book was written, not by the guy whose name is on it, not by the publisher whose publisher's name is on the title page, but we want to find, you know, a way this book arose without any intelligence involved. Well, you can look there all you want, but you're looking in the wrong area. And, that's simply what many people are pointing out. Now, to say that science, or you said the view of mainstream science is that life is an emergent property of matter, that is a religious statement. That certainly has never, there's been nothing that science has ever discovered that would give that impression. Instead, it's a faith statement, and it's a faith statement of those who believe that science can explain everything. But if you don't have that kind of a gratuitous faith, then you can make more sensible statements and say, life arose from living sources. That's the only place life ever arose from.
Yeah. Emergent properties, we know about all sorts of emergent properties. We don't have, you're right, we don't have a start-to-finish emergent property method for life, but we do have lots of emergent properties that we know of, and that's okay. What's giving people this clue.
Well, John, I'll tell you what. Worth looking at. I'll tell you what, keep looking. The scientists who want to keep looking for that, they've got my blessing. They can look and look and look all they want. And if they find something, they can tell me what they found. I'd be glad to hear from them. But, you know, it's like looking for your cell phone in another room when your wife already found it in the living room. You know, you can keep looking if you want to. There are better ways to use your time. But if that's, you see, a person who is insistent that science can prove everything, that's a person who believes in scientism, and that's a religion. Science itself cannot tell you whether science can solve all mysteries. That's a philosophical question and a religious question, not a scientific question. So it sounds to me like what you're in favor of is the idea that we should think that science can solve all the mysteries. And we got freedom of religion here. You can hold that religion. I'm going to hold a religion that actually makes some sense. That's at least makes sense to me. Okay, you follow the one that makes sense to you. I do appreciate your calls. Now, if you want to, I need to take other calls, but if you want to in the future call with a particular, a particular challenge, like an evolutionary point that you'd like to hear answered, I'd be glad to hear from that. It seems like when we've been calling, we've been kind of all over the place and haven't really nailed down one particular concern. But
Next time, I feel like we have. I don't know if other people feel like
okay.
that, but I feel like we have. Hopefully next time I'll prepare some, like a 2-minute lesson on lichen, how fungus and algae form lichen. And we could discuss that a little bit.
Okay, great.
That's okay. But I appreciate the time. It's been nice chatting with you.
Okay, John. Thank you. I appreciate your call. Have a good day. Bye now. All right. We'll talk to Kent from Salinas, California next. Kent, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Nice to hear from you.
Great to hear from you again.
So lately I've been trying to brush up more on apologetics, and of course the resurrection is a huge element to that. And
right.
I was just wondering if what have you come to realize is some of the best evidence in support of the resurrection, whether that be biblical or extra-biblical kind of evidence.
Okay. Well, the best argument for the resurrection I know of is twofold. And the Gospels in the Bible all bring these two things up. One is that after Jesus died, his tomb was emptied, and that has to be explained somehow. Now, I'm not saying that the resurrection is the only explanation that has ever been floated, but it certainly is the only one that makes any sense compared to the others that are suggested. If the empty tomb, I mean, historically we know that Jesus lived. We know that from secular historians. We know it from the eyewitness accounts, from the Gospels, and so forth. So there's no question that Jesus lived, and therefore no one will dispute that he died. The real question is what happened to him after that. And the fact that his friends found his tomb empty 3 days after his burial is something to explain. His tomb is certainly empty. It's empty now, and it was empty 3 days after he was raised, because if it was not, his enemies would gladly have refuted the apostles. The enemies of the gospel would gladly have gone to the tomb and presented the body and said, that's the end of Christianity. There's no resurrected Jesus. Here's his moldering corpse right here in the tomb. But they couldn't do that because it wasn't there. So the fact that his tomb wasn't occupied has to be explained. You put a dead body in a tomb, later it's gone. It either got up and left by itself, or someone carried it out. But there were precautions taken to prevent people from carrying it out. There were guards set there. The tomb was sealed shut. It was watched. And he got out anyway. The Jews and the Romans, who might have had the power to remove the body, didn't have any motive to do it. And if they had moved it, they would have certainly the motivation to reveal the fact that they had done so. Once the disciples started saying Jesus rose from the dead, if his enemies actually had moved the body, they would gladly have shown the body to the public and said, look, Jesus did not rise from the dead. The fact that they never did that or never claimed anything like that, that they had moved the body, indicates that that's probably not what happened. The disciples might have moved the body, but why would they? What interest did they have in moving the body out or even proclaiming that Jesus had risen from the dead? What good did that ever do them? They never made any money off it. They never got anything but persecution and martyrdom out of it. It's not even clear why they would even think that was a good idea to do. I mean, unless someone can come up with a better answer than I've ever heard for somebody, anybody, removing the body from the tomb and keeping that a secret, then I'm going to have to say that the removal of the body by people is not a good suggestion. Then you've got the other business. Besides the empty tomb, you've got the witnesses. There's lots of people who saw him raised from the dead. That they didn't see him rise. They saw him after he rose from the dead. They touched him. They conversed with him. And these were people who were skeptical. People like Thomas. He didn't believe that he was going to see Jesus risen from the dead. In fact, he said he wouldn't believe it unless he saw him and touched him. And yet he came around. Actually, all the apostles, when they first heard the report from the women who had gone to the tomb that Jesus rose, they didn't believe it. They were skeptical, but then they changed their minds when they met him risen from the dead. And then there's the fact that after Jesus was gone, after he'd risen and gone to heaven, the apostles suddenly had supernatural powers similar to those that Jesus had exercised. So that they raised the dead, and they healed the sick, and they opened the eyes of the blind, and they did all those things, and they said it was him continuing to work through them as he said he would. So we've got an empty tomb to account for. We've got appearances of Jesus to very many people who had known him, who were skeptical until they saw him. They weren't people who saw him because of wishful thinking. They didn't expect to see him. He surprised them. You've got the fact that these people later had the same powers he had and said, wow, this is him continuing to work through us. If someone has some good explanations against that stuff, I'm always eager to hear them. But I've certainly read the skeptics, and there's been an awful lot of skeptics who had set out to disprove the resurrection of Jesus and became believers by their research, by seeking to disprove it. One of those was Peter Stoner, who moved the stone. He was a lawyer and a skeptic, and he set out to disprove the resurrection. And in the process of actually looking at the data, he was compelled to become a believer. He's not the only one. I've heard of many others who have had that experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were also books written. One book in particular my pastor has on his shelf in his office is, I can't remember the title, but it's all secular evidence in support of the resurrection, that there's enough secular evidence that is actually
If Jesus didn't die and resurrect in 30 AD, as the Bible says he did, then someone has to account for the fact that in less than two decades after that, by the year 50, there were significant numbers of Christians in Rome who believed that he had. Now, this is well within the lifetime of people who had seen Jesus. And how in the world would Christianity have convinced thousands of people that Jesus rose from the dead if his body was somehow available for viewing somewhere, or if there weren't some compelling reasons for them to believe? These people actually laid down their lives for their testimony. So you've got to find some explanation of why people would do that. Why would people do that? What did the apostles who spread this message, what did they have to gain? They didn't charge for their ministry. That was against Jesus' teaching. Jesus said, freely you've received, freely give. You don't charge for ministry. So they didn't get any money for it, or they didn't get rich certainly from it. They didn't get to live a carousing, partying, happy-go-lucky life. They had to live holy lives, because that was what Jesus taught them to do, and that's what the movement they headed up required. So they didn't get to go out and just have a lot of fun. And then they got to be tortured and imprisoned and killed for their faith. So it's really hard to explain why they would start something that they knew to be false and then go through all that. What motivates that? I mean, there certainly have been people who've been charlatans who started stuff to get rich or to get some other advantage for themselves. The apostles didn't get any such advantages. There have been people who've died for their beliefs but not knowing they were false. People who die for their beliefs really believe what they're believing. They might be wrong, but they don't know they're wrong. The apostles, if they had not found the tomb empty, if they had stolen the body, for example, they would know they were lying. They would know that what they were saying wasn't true. And therefore, it's hard to explain why they would die for something that they knew wasn't true.
Yeah. Were there any, just one last question, were there any famous groups of people that were unbelieving people that were trying to find Jesus' body but didn't believe the word of the apostles and were kind of like trying to scavenge for his body somehow?
Well, we don't know of them because they didn't ever have a successful movement or leave records of what they did. I mean, but I'm sure that with the apostles causing such a problem in Jerusalem by saying that Jesus rose from the dead, I'm sure that the Jewish people who were so annoyed by this would have, the first thing they would have thought of is to go and check the tomb. Let's go make sure he's not there. That'd be the easy solution to this, to find him there. We don't read of all the things people did to try to disprove it, but they'd have to be pretty dull critics if they didn't do something as simple as going to see if Jesus was in the tomb or not. I mean, it was just down the street.
Right. And isn't that like one of the big, like one of the major tasks of the Jesus seminar is to disprove the resurrection? But
well, the Jesus seminar, they're trying to reinterpret Jesus. I don't know if the resurrection was their main target. They spent 6 years trying to prove that Jesus didn't say most of the things that he's recorded as saying. And then they spent another 6 years trying to prove that his miracles were mostly not true. But they didn't prove anything. They just voted on it. I mean, you know, science isn't done by getting a bunch of scientists together and taking a vote. Science is done by looking at evidence and doing experiments and things like that. If a bunch of scientists get together and say, well, what do you suppose is on the dark side of the moon? Yeah, me too. Let's vote that way on it. Without observation, without exploration, their vote is not worth much. And that's what the Jesus seminar was. There were a bunch of scholars who just got together to vote on whether they, do you think Jesus said this? No, I don't either. Okay, let's vote against it. You know? Well, that's what they did. That's what they did.
Right.
I mean, and then they did say the good miracles. Do you think Jesus did that miracle? No, I don't think so. I agree with you. I think he didn't either. So let's vote against it. I mean, they had 70 guys in a room voting on every little thing, and they were all skeptics. None of them were Christians. Or, I mean, I shouldn't say none of them were Christians. There might have been a few Christians in the room, but virtually all the people in Jesus' seminar were unbelievers. So of course they're not going to have a very positive opinion of whether Jesus rose from the dead. They wouldn't be unbelievers if they were favorable toward that conclusion.
Okay. Well, I'll let you get to your other callers. I know that you've had a lot of people calling in. So,
all right, Kent.
I'll call you at another day.
All right. God bless you, man.
Okay. You too.
Good talking to you. Bye now.
You too.
All right. Our next caller is Norma from Portland, Oregon. Norma, welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi. Thank you. I think it was your program the other day. I was listening to about Revelation. About was it yours that said there was 200 million troops, and they were saying, well, how would they feed a number of mounted troops?
Yeah, well, it was not. Yeah. It was actually a caller that brought that up, but it was on my show. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, probably I'm really simple, but I've always loved reading Revelation, and and I feel like I understand it, and I've heard you say several times, I think, that sometimes you think some things are like a picture of something and some things aren't, and it's hard to tell. To me, it's not hard to tell. To me, it's very obvious. Anyway, it says right in there, the horses and riders I saw in my vision looked like this. Their breastplates were fiery red, dark blue, and yellow as sulfur. The heads of the horses resembled the heads of lions, and out of their mouths came fire and smoke and sulfur. A third of mankind was killed by a plague of the fire smoke. Well, they're tanks. I mean, they didn't have tanks back in those days. So he couldn't say they're tanks. They didn't even have gas engines. And to me, it's so plain.
Why, you know, why would that now?
We have 300 cars of
so a horse,
cars of food.
A horse with a rider that has a head like a lion and a tail like a snake is obviously
a
tank.
Well, he saw that big thing, the lump on top of the of a tank. And the tail, you know, they've got where the fire comes out, where the rockets come out. I mean, what he saw, he described it as a horse because what people didn't ride any machines. They rode animals.
Well, but they had chariots. I would think, see, tanks don't have legs. Tanks have wheels, and chariots have wheels and carts. You'd think he would say, I saw chariots, you know.
Well, he didn't.
Yeah, I know.
He didn't. But to me, it's not horses. Horses don't have fire coming out of their mouths and all that kind of stuff.
Well, I agree with you. I agree with you that this was not literally talking about horses with fire coming out of their mouths. Okay. Well, thanks for your call. Let me just follow up on this. The guy who called me about that yesterday, whose name is Steve, he sent me an email to follow up. And he was just talking about this. By the way, it'd be just as big a problem if there were 200 million tanks. First of all, I don't know how many tanks America has in their entire armed forces. I would imagine it numbers in the thousands, but not in the millions. But even if it was a million, I doubt it. But if it was a million, where are you going to get 200 million? And where are you going to get the fuel for those? Frankly, I think you have a bigger problem if they're tanks than if they're horses, because a horse only eats 30 pounds of food a day. A tank, the fuel for that thing would be, you'd have to have a tank truck carrying the fuel for that to go some distance from China to Israel. That's a long way to drive a tank. And they probably get about 5 miles to the gallon of diesel fuel. I don't really know. But the point is, the guy who called me about that actually followed up with an email. He said, let me just read what he said. He said, one war horse would eat 30 pounds of food a day. That's 200 million horses by 30 pounds is 6 billion pounds a day of food. So now, frankly, I think if it was tanks, you'd have to even have more than that quantity of fuel, because a horse eats less than a tank does. This army would require 6 billion pounds of food a day, which is 3 million tons, which would require 30,000 50-foot, 100-ton capacity boxcars. The train that would bring the food for one day for these horses would have to be a train 284 miles long. Now, see, we're talking about 200 million horses. You'd have to have a train 284 miles long every day bringing the food for these horses. I think that's not very realistic. Now, let's say they're tanks. We still got the same issues. We still got the fuel needed for them and so forth. There's some interesting stuff here. Said if they traveled by train from the heart of China 3,000 miles away and 12 horse and rider combos were loaded into these 50-foot boxcars, approximately 16.7 million train cars would be needed. By the way, if you're going to transport tanks on a train, you're not going to put 16.7 tanks in a boxcar. You're going to put one tank on a flat car. So you're going to need 200 million train cars to carry 200 million tanks if they're going to go by train. You don't have that many train cars. He said that, he's got all kinds of interesting facts here that I can't go into because he's got a lot of it, but he said that the line of them would just circle the globe, several times. I don't have time to get into all this, but the point is, it's nice to suggest they're tanks, but it doesn't solve the problem. I personally don't think they're tanks, But in any case, if they are, you've got the same kind of problem that the caller was raising, and that is that the fuel for that many horses would be impossible to transport. It'd be even harder to transport them enough fuel for tanks. And where are we going to get 200 million tanks? I don't know what the total number of tanks in the world is, but I'm guessing it's under 1 million. And there'd have to be some pretty massive production. And why would anyone send 200 million tanks against Israel? You could just send a missile, you know, one missile. Why would you transport 200 million tanks? You'd have to manufacture 199 million more than there already exist just to invade this little tiny country, which you couldn't even fit the tanks in the country. They wouldn't fit there. So to my mind, the number 200 million is symbolic. Frankly, that's what I'm thinking. And I don't think it's referring to tanks either. But that's certainly, I've heard other people suggest that these are tanks and that the locusts are helicopters and so forth. That's been a popular view since the days of Hal Lindsey, and maybe before that time, too. I appreciate your input, though. I appreciate your calling. Brandon from Albuquerque, New Mexico is next, and we have a line open for you at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. And Brandon, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, Steve. It's good to be on your program. Just wanted to say a couple things about, there's another caller a week or two ago. He had said he couldn't get any of your lectures. He's trying to get an old lecture.
Oh, yeah?
So I've been getting your afternoon lectures from theos.org/media.
You mean the radio shows?
All of them up there.
You mean the radio shows?
I'm sorry? Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, not lectures, but radio shows?
Your radio lectures. Okay. And then also, another caller had talked about his wife, someone he'd married had come up with STDs. Well,
yeah.
There's a guy named Robert Morse. He's a naturopathic doctor.
Uh-huh.
And he claimed to have cured STDs, so I just thought I'd throw that out there. The reason I'm calling is I was listening to one of your lectures on sin or sickness.
Yeah.
And I wasn't too sure what your stand is on that, but if your stand is that mental illness doesn't exist, then I'd have to disagree with you.
Okay.
Because
make your case.
Well, before I was a Christian, I had had a bad bout with OCD, just racing thoughts and everything.
Uh-huh.
Stressed out all the time, and I'd count things, and I'd do my rituals, and I ended up learning more. I mean, I found out that certain medications were good for them, but I didn't want to go that route. And but I ended up coming across a high carb diet for OCD, and I tried everything, and some things worked, some things didn't. But I'm finally now free of my racing thoughts.
That's good. Was it mainly through the diet rather than through drugs?
I can't prove it.
Yeah. Was that mainly through your change of diet?
Yeah. Apparently serotonin has something to do with depression,
uh-huh.
especially in OCD cases. And
let me just say this. That would not be technically a mental illness, and that'd be a brain illness.
Go ahead.
See, some people just assume the brain and the mind are the same thing. What I'm trying to mention in my lecture is the brain and the mind are different things. The mind is who you are. Your brain is one of the organs in your body. Your mind employs the brain to send messages to the nervous system and so forth and to control your body. But your mind is comprised not of the just the electrical charges in your brain. Your mind is your personality, who you are. It's your mind is your values and your opinions and your beliefs and your thoughts and your emotions and so forth. Now, those do interact with your brain and with your nerves and with other parts of your body. But if indeed your OCD was caused by physical things, which can be cured by a diet, then that was apparently a physical problem, not a mental problem. See, I believe that.
Well, what?
Go ahead.
I'm just thinking. Well, it did affect the way I acted around people, and
sure.
And your point was, well, it's all my fault, and maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. I don't know, but I do know that something physical was going on there too.
Well, I never said it was all your fault. I don't know you. I don't know what's your fault and what's not your fault. All I'm saying is that if it has a physical cause, it's a physical illness, not a mental illness. The problem here is that when people talk about schizophrenia and several other things that are called mental illness, they're not talking about something that can be proven to have a physical cause. If they could, it'd be a physical illness. For example, sometimes people's behavior is weird because of hypoglycemia or thyroid problems or any number of other chemical things that go wrong in a person. Well, then that's a physical problem. That's not a mental problem. That's something for a regular doctor, not a psychiatrist or a counselor. But if there are problems that are not physical, that don't have a physical cause, then I refer to that as being better understood to have a spiritual connection rather than calling it a mental illness.
Okay.
But I didn't. I never said that your OCD was your fault. I don't have any opinion about that. I don't know you, but I'm saying that there is a difference to be made between physical illness and spiritual issues that people have. And what has happened in the modern secular world is they've eliminated the whole category of spiritual issues and they've given them a name, mental illness, and that's a different. I'm saying that spiritual condition is often a factor that's mislabeled as a mental illness, but many behaviors.
I just wanted to say one more thing before I left the air.
Okay.
Supposedly, I've heard from different sources that many of these shootings, like the Columbine and the kindergartner shooter, and all of those, these people were on medication.
That's right.
And so I guess maybe that would help your point in a way.
Yeah. I think so. I mean, yeah, almost.
Medications, obviously.
Yeah, I've seen a list. I've seen a list of all the shooters, school shooters and those kinds of people, and a list of all the medications they were on. And virtually, I mean, there might be an exception, one or two, but in a list of like 20 or 30 cases, all of them were on some kind of psychiatric medications. Virtually all of them, maybe with one or two exceptions. And so the common denominator was not guns, but psychotraumatic, meds. Yeah.
Problems. Yeah, and maybe the meds themselves. Okay, I'll let you go. I know you have other callers, but
okay, Brandon.
It's a real privilege talking. Thank you.
Thank you for calling. Good to hear from you. Bye now. Brittany from Las Vegas, Nevada is next. Brittany, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks
Hi,
for calling.
How are you?
Hi.
I'm Brittany from Las Vegas. I have a question. I recently came across an article and read into a little bit of the sources regarding Nimrod, the character. I can't call him character, but the person known as Nimrod in Genesis. I want to say it's Genesis 10, which led to the Babylonian kingdom,
right,
and among other Cush and all of those things. Nimrod is listed as Noah's grandson or great-grandson. I can't remember. But some things that were proposed to me was that Nimrod in our, whether it be the New King James Version or the King James or whatever, because I looked through Bible Gateway, lots of our American translations say that Nimrod was a great hunter and he was mighty before the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
But a friend of mine is an Orthodox Jew.
Uh-huh.
And when he looked into, I suppose Josephus is one of the historians or something of that time, mm-hmm. and he indicated that Nimrod was actually a wicked man.
Uh-huh.
That him being mighty before the Lord is another interpretation would be like if you're standing face to face with someone and you're trying to argue with them or fight with them or whatever, you're against each other.
Yeah.
And it was not a good thing before God. And I just wanted to know if you've done any studies on this this person or this kingdom that supposedly propelled Babylon, the anger that he had against God for the flood and everything, and he decided, or at least what they're saying, he decided or perpetuated the building of the Tower of Babel because he was so angry against God, or he turned people away from God. Have you done any study on this?
Well, I've studied Nimrod before. Yeah, I don't know very much about his motivations. Nimrod is the founder of the Tower of Babel, and therefore of the Babylonian society, which later became a Babylonian empire, much later. When it says he's a mighty hunter before the Lord, there are people who translate it that he was a mighty hunter against the Lord. So that seems to support one of the things you were saying. There's very little said about him in the Bible, and it's hard to know who to associate with him within secular history, but there are mentions of persons in, secular records from the ancient times that are often thought to refer to Nimrod. Some think that Gilgamesh may have been Nimrod.
The epic or something like that.
Yeah, the Gilgamesh epic. And there are other theories. I mean, many people believe he was the son of, that his son was Tammuz. And so forth.
Isn't that related? That's related to like the creation of the sun, the pagan worship of sun,
Something like that. Yeah, years ago, a few generations ago, a guy named Alexander Hislop wrote a large volume called The Two Babylons, and he had a lot of information about Nimrod in there, which many people have questioned. In fact, I think some people have said that it's been in the years since that was written that a lot of it has been debunked. I have not studied it intensively, only because it's not one of my most compelling interests. But my assumption has always been, like your own, from what we are told, that he is the founder of the Tower of Babel. And the Tower of Babel was built in rebellion against God. So we know he was in rebellion against God. We don't know why. We don't know if he was angry about the flood, like I think you suggested, or if he was just ambitious and wanted everyone to follow him. Lots of men have had that in them. So we aren't told much about his motivations.
Okay. I think that's it.
Okay, Brittany. So I don't know much more about him, but there's a lot of secular. A lot of people have linked him with certain secular, records about things. But it's as far as whether he's the same guy or not is perhaps something that not everyone would agree about.
I see. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
All right. I appreciate your call. Thanks for calling me, Joe. From Las Vegas. Joe, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Well, hello, Steve. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you.
Good. Hey, I wanted to, first of all, compliment you. I've been listening for several weeks since my last time I've called, and although I have studied Bible prophecy for 30 years, and if I told you the people I've studied, I'm sure you remember or heard of them all. I realize how little I know of the rest of the Bible versus your breadth of knowledge and your expertise. So I'm learning a lot, and how you deal and handle customers or your callers is very noteworthy. So I do appreciate listening to you and hearing your callers and your advice and your response to them.
Well, I appreciate you saying so. Thank you.
One of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is it reminded me of this question of the person you talked to a couple days ago who said he was an atheist. And I have a family member who is a little bit antagonistic to, at times, the Christian or the Jesus, the idea of why God allows bad things to happen to good people. Mm-hmm. And I've told him, this Oklahoma, more Oklahoma, the tragedy there with the tornado is just a recent event. But I told him about what I knew. It's appointed once, upon man to die once and mm-hmm. then the judgment. And it was their time. And all of us have sinned and come short of the glory of God. And I told him about Job, how righteous of a man he was, and yet God allowed, suffering to come to him and his family. But as he always leaves with that look of, is that the best you can do? Or I don't accept that. Do you, first of all, do you think I told him pretty much right? And what's your input? I think that's a lot of Christians who really strive to, with faith in God. When they see really evil stuff happen, that Oklahoma City bombings and the Boston bombings and innocent kids getting killed in particular, why does God allow seemingly the good and innocent people to die, and sometimes people that are just the meanest son of a guns on the planet, they seem to live a long life and or appears that way? What are your thoughts and input, and what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, I mean, with your friend who's not a Christian, my thoughts would probably carry very little weight because from my youth, I've always understood the difference between eternity and time, and that life is very short for all of us. Even those who live to be 100 years, that's only a tiny fraction of history, and it's not even a measurable dot in eternity. So, nobody lives very long, and some people live very short. A person who dies when they're 2 years old differs from a person who dies at 100 years old by only 98 years, a speck in history, a speck in eternity. And therefore, to say, well, why did God let these people die such and such a way? I guess I'd have to say, well, how did you want them to die? Everyone's going to die. You don't like the way God let them die? How would you prefer? Would you prefer they lived a few more years and then had a lingering death of cancer? That's the way a lot of people die. I mean, everybody dies. So, I mean, we can, that's not a callous statement. That's just an honest observation. And if we're going to try to understand, you know, tragedies where people die, we need to look, first of all, at the fact that every single person who died in any tragedy would have died some other way eventually, and not much longer later, maybe a few decades at the most. So the real question is there any justice in the universe? If there's not, then that raises questions about whether there's a good God out there. If there is ultimately justice in the universe, it's not during this lifetime. It must be something that's settled later. Now, the person who, let's say, dies at age 5 years old and goes on to stand before God and be admitted into an eternal life of bliss, and he goes there and he finds someone who died at age 35 and another person who died at age 95, and they're in eternal bliss too, I don't think the child who died at 5 is going to say, shoot, how come I had to get here so quickly? You know, I mean, what's the difference between 95 and 5 if what we're looking at is eternity now? It's just a blip. It's an immeasurable blip, life is. And I've always had that perspective because that's the biblical perspective and it's reality. The truth is there is such a thing as eternity. Now, not everyone agrees about what happens in eternity. Some people think that when you die, you don't have any ongoing existence in eternity. Others believe you do. I happen to believe that you do. And because I believe that, I have a totally different perspective from someone who doesn't. To me, God's vindication comes not by at what point in time he allows me to die or in what way. I'm going to die one way or another, and when I do, the people who love me will be unhappy. It won't matter if I'm 95 or 65. It's not going to be 55 because I'm beyond that now. So if I die today, that'll make my wife and my children unhappy. If I die 30 years from now, that'll make my wife and my children unhappy if they haven't died first. You know, it doesn't really matter when you die. People who love you are going to be sad. That's one of the sad things about life, is that we die. But the real question is, does God make it up? Does God settle the scores? In eternity, which is so long that time is hardly even worth consideration, by contrast, in eternity, the Bible says God makes it up. Those who are truly righteous are rewarded. Those who are truly wicked are punished. And that's as we would expect it to be if there's a just God. So, I mean, for us to look only at tragedies that happen in this lifetime is to have an earthbound, time-bound perspective that is not really taking in the whole panoramic view that God gives us. God says there's an eternity out there, and there's eternal rewards. Now, I still don't know. I don't have the answer why some people, you know, in a plane that crashes, there's some bad people in there and some good people in there. There's some babies and little children, and there's some really old people who've probably lived long enough. There's all kinds of people in there, and they all die the same day. But I don't know really why that's any bigger a problem to deal with than if they all died on different days. They all die, and then they face eternity. What's it matter whether they face eternity the same day or on different days a few years apart? I think people react to these things emotionally without using their brains. And when you use your brain, they get upset with you. They say, you're not sensitive, you know? You shouldn't be thinking, you should be feeling. Well, I think we all do feel. Anyone who's sensible feels. I mean, when I heard just yesterday of five teenagers in Orange County who were killed in an accident. And I felt about them as if they were my own kids in their teens. That breaks my heart. It brought tears to my eyes. And I hear those things every day. I have feelings about it. But when it comes to deciding, is this justifiable by God? Why didn't God stop this from happening? Then we have to put our feelings sort of aside and say, let's look at this rationally. If we're going to talk about justice, we're going to have to talk about justice from a rational point of view, not a visceral point of view. And I'm afraid that too many people have never learned how to think rationally. They just feel about the things they want to feel about. And when it comes to making judgments about God's justice, they put their rationality out the window and they just say, I'm angry at God. That's an emotion I'm feeling. And God has a lot of explaining to do. And if he doesn't satisfy me with his explanation, I'm going to keep being angry. Well, you can't stop them. If they want to be irrational, they can be. That's one of the possibilities God built into people. They can be irrational if they want to. And I don't have any respect for people who choose to be irrational. I mean, I respect them, but I don't respect their thinking because they're not thinking like rational beings. I mean, they're thinking like children or like you know, they're not thinking like humans who have rational capacity.
Well said, Steve, and I agree 100%. I always find though that when I'm done talking to this individual, it's frustrating because it's just no matter what you say, sometimes, of course, I didn't say it quite as eloquently as you did, but this person is just unwilling to say God's in control, and you're right. Even Jesus cried. With Lazarus, didn't he? I believe the Bible said so. He had tears, and he raised him from the dead. So, once again, it shows Jesus' human side of his emotions that it was okay. But well, Steve, thank you very much. I appreciate that, and well spoken, well said, and I agree. And I'll continue to listen. And God bless. Thank you.
All right. Well, it's good to hear from you, Joe. Thanks for your call. And we have calls waiting to go on the air, but. In less than 30 seconds, the theme music will be playing. I'll be winding this down. I'll be out of time. And my apologies to those who are waiting to go on the air. I wish I could have gotten to you earlier. But Lord willing, we'll be on the air again tomorrow. We're on Monday through Friday. As long as the Lord wills, we'll live and do this. And as long as the money comes in to buy radio time, too, which is another part of God's will. If God wills for the program to continue, money will come, and we'll pay for the time, and we'll keep doing this. By the way, when I talk about money coming in, we're just talking about money to pay the radio stations. We don't have any other real expenses here. We don't have any payroll. There's no one paid here. It's just that we need to spend tens of thousands of dollars a month on buying the radio time. That's how we stay on the air. That money is entirely comes from listeners. We don't have any commercials. We don't have any products that we sell. We don't have any underwriters or sponsors. We just tell you, the listener, if you'd like to hear us continue on the radio, we're going to have to pay the bills. And if you'd like to help us do that, that's exactly how it happens. If you'd like to help us pay the radio bills, you can write to The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, 92593. Or you can go to our website. You'll find the address there. Or you can just donate from the website. We'd be glad to get the finances from any source because we like to stay on the air, and we do that for the listener and not for us, not that we get anything out of it, not anything material out of it anyway. But it's a ministry that we think is worthwhile, and so we'll keep doing it as long as God keeps providing. The website, again, is thenarrowpath.com. And if you don't want to donate, go there anyway because there's lots of free things there. Everything's free. And there's valuable MP3s and things you can just download from the website, thenarrowpath.com. Have a good evening, and tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion. God bless you. Bye-bye.